Good afternoon. I'm Signe Shackelford, and I'm a policy analyst at the Center for Mississippi Health Policy. I'm here today to talk about a data match that we did in the state of Mississippi with the hopes that I can save from y'all some of the trouble that we had with that particular project. I have no relationships to disclose. I'm pressing page down. Is it page down? Okay. No relationships to disclose. Our learning objectives for this afternoon, I'm just going to kind of put the prescription monitoring program in context. I'm going to discuss this data match that we did in the state of Mississippi using vital records data and prescription monitoring data and talk about kind of the lessons that we learned in that project. So a little about where I work now. The Center for Mississippi Health Policy is an independent nonprofit research organization. We're primarily foundation-funded, so we don't have a dog in this fight. We're mainly here just to provide unbiased research information. In some cases, we do the research. In some cases, we outsource that. In this particular project, we kind of served as a convening party for the groups listed here. So we work closely with the Board of Pharmacy, which administers the prescription monitoring program, and we also worked with the Mississippi State Department of Health's Office of Vital Records, and the Division of Pharmacy at the Health Department. Many of you might have been in the presentation yesterday where we saw this slide. I was glad to see, I think it was Dr. Jones who used it. This is just to put kind of this whole effort in context. So we know that prescription drug abuse, that accidental poisonings driven largely by drug poisonings are an increasing issue in this country. In Mississippi, we haven't gotten there quite yet, but the trends are converging in a similar fashion to what we've seen nationally, and we do have higher motor vehicle crash rates than the rest of the country, so that might be a contributing factor. One answer to this epidemic has been to implement prescription monitoring programs, and this is a map that shows you that they're available. They're currently active in 43 states, and then the remaining states have legislation in place. Is anybody from Montana in here? I mean, Missouri? Do you know if y'all have a PMP?
No, we don't.
Okay. I looked it up online this morning, and it seemed that there was some legislation, but it was only being used by pharmacists. So.
There's no legislation for it, unfortunately.
Okay. So Missouri still remains without a prescription monitoring program. In Mississippi, the prescription monitoring program began in 2004, and we began collecting controlled substance prescriptions dispensed in or into the state of Mississippi. It's administered by the Board of Pharmacy, and it's a very small organization. It's one staff. So part of kind of some of the issues that we'll get into later, I think, are related to limited resources for that organization. The project that we undertook began in June of 2012. I approached the Mississippi Prescription Monitoring Program and the State Health Department. I began to make introductory meetings. We started kind of a white paper background research. We moved into the phase of setting up the actual data match, so where we took all of the 232 unintentional drug overdose deaths from 2011, and we ran them through the PMP. At this point, we ran into a vendor who was either unwilling or unable to provide this information to us electronically, so we actually had to get the reports in PDF form and re-enter, and it was about 8,000 lines of records. They were able to export them in Excel, but the columns were merged, and I'm not sure. You know, to this day, we haven't gotten a good answer as to why that wasn't possible. My suspicion is that we were changing vendors in the state, and they didn't really have a big motivation to undertake such a large data export. But we were undeterred. So after 5 months of our administrative assistant entering these records from the PDFs to the Excel sheet and a really nice lunch that we took her out to and my daily apologizing to her, we were able to get the information analyzed to staff. We updated the lit review because at this point we'd been working on the project for a year, so we had some updated information. And then we began disseminating the information both in-state and nationally just about our experience doing this type of work. And we're by no means the first state to do this. Ohio is who we modeled our program on. So. this just gives you kind of an idea of the overview, and I think this also was touched on in the keynote yesterday. What we're interested in is the 25% of accidental drug poisoning deaths that are drug-related, but the drug is not specified on the death certificate. In Mississippi, that 78% of our drug deaths are not specified on the death certificate. So we're trying to find a different way to get at what drugs are these individuals taking. One way to do that is with the T codes, which are an additional descriptive element of death certificates. And as you can see, where that becomes problematic is on these particular 232 deaths, you have 194 that have other non-specified. You can also have more than one T code on a death certificate. So we had other unspecified and another drug indicated on the death certificate. So we sat down with the Department of Health and the Board of Pharmacy, and we kind of said, how can we look at these deaths and try to figure out what these people were taking before accident? And these are people whose deaths were classified as accidental drug overdose. So we were able to get the information entered and do a demographic breakdown. The average age was 45 years old for the group. The youngest was 16, the oldest was 86. Half men, half women, 90% white. And that to me is, this could be an issue of reporting, of a disparity of reporting on deaths in other communities. I'll just say that I'm not entirely convinced that that's representative of what's actually happening with our deaths. So when we looked at the 232 deaths, we had 52 records that were not admissible for our study period. We took the deaths and we ran the name, date of birth, addresses in some cases. We were able to find all but 52 of them. 40 of those individuals they were in the PMP, but they didn't have any records for controlled substance prescriptions for the 2 years prior to death, and 12 of them just weren't in the system at all. But that 40, I think, would be really interesting going forward to look at. Were these people who were kind of pushed out of the system, who developed a problem, and then maybe had to seek other means for obtaining their prescription drugs? So we included 180 in our study. And I'll give you some information now about what we found about them. They had between 1 and 196 prescriptions during the 2 years prior to death for controlled substances, and this is over a two-year period. So at most, at the high end, we had somebody who had about 100 prescriptions for controlled substances in those 2 years. The average was 43 prescriptions for these individuals who died of overdose. The number of doses, which basically is pills, is between 15 and 16,000. So I point that out just to say there's a huge variety, but to me, if somebody is receiving an average of about 8,000 pills a year, that provides maybe an opportunity for intervention. I thought that was really striking. So the average was about 2,800 pills per person, and that's, again, over the two-year period. So still about 1,000 doses per person in the individuals who died. We broke it down by gender. We didn't have any significant differences between the gender, but just from a descriptive standpoint, the average age for men was 40. They saw an average number of, I thought it skewed towards the low side of the number of prescribers. And this kind of information, when I present this to policymakers in Mississippi, what I say is, this is why we need data so that when we implement policies for limiting the number of individuals, the number of prescribers they can see or the number of dispensers, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a minute, but we need to know what the baseline is. So these are for people who died of unintentional drug overdose death. They went to 4 dispensers in the 2 years prior to death, so that's about 2 dispensers a year. That's about 3 prescribers per year. This is the breakdown for women, a little bit older than our male population. The distribution by drug schedule fell about as you would expect. It was at the lower end for the, as the schedule increases, it means that it's less controlled. So I think our first speaker spoke to that point, but we saw about 19% were scheduled 2, 31% were scheduled 3. So the larger number of prescriptions were less controlled. This is the prescriptions by drug category, and in this slide we developed with the Health Department's pharmacy division, and they gave us from the American Hospital formulary system. So this is really just for when I go out and speak to policymakers and I talk to them about these different medications. They don't want to hear, you know, hydrocodone plus acetaminophen. They just want to know painkillers or sedatives. So we have, I can give anybody the information on how we broke these down. It was a big struggle, but you have to make things relatable to the people who are receiving the information. I'll point out on this slide that only 5% of the individuals who died had zero opioid prescriptions in the 2 years prior to death. And then another 5% had six or more. So the six or more over the 2 years prior to death, that's the number of unique opioid prescriptions prior to dying of unintentional drug overdose. Again, the number of prescribers I thought was on the low side. It was more than half of the group had fewer than five prescribers in the 2 years prior to death. And then when we look at the 905 prescribers in the study group who wrote for this population, 82% wrote fewer than 10 of the total prescriptions, and 3% wrote 50 or more prescriptions for this group who died of accidental drug overdose. So, again, another example for where you might want to target your efforts. This was conducted with, you know, privacy, so we would never turn that information over, but the Board of Pharmacy was very interested in kind of getting to know who these individuals were. Almost half had three or fewer dispensers. And when you look at the source of payment, this is another example as kind of a lesson learned. We don't know why not available was an option. So somebody's paying for the medication. So this is probably just a glitch, and this is something that was corrected after I, you know, performed this research. We went back to the Board of Pharmacy and said, why is not available an option? Is that cash or what? And there really wasn't a good answer for that. But you do see, if it is cash, that that's a very large proportion of the payments are coming from cash. So what would be interesting, I think, as another project, as an ancillary project, would be to look at what types of coverage these individuals have and how that correlates with potential diversion or, you know, if you have insurance and you're paying cash for a lot of narcotic prescriptions, that might be an area to implement, again, an intervention to identify people who are diverting. So it is our hope that eventually we'll be able to get this information in an electronic format and we'll be able to do a larger data match with the 30,000 deaths that occur in Mississippi annually. We know that this is a really big underreporting problem. We know that there are more people dying from this in Mississippi each year. So we think that if we could analyze the trends for all deaths to see against the PMP, and the PMP is really willing to do this, that we would be able to maybe craft more effective policy around this. We are doing regular reporting to the PMP Advisory Board for de-identified data to look at trends. And the use of other data sets, we looked at like our Narcan administrations from the emergency services research. We looked at some Medicaid data. So I think that there's a lot of other layers of information that you could put against the PMP in order to kind of paint a more complete picture. And we hope to continue doing that. These are just some resources that might be helpful to y'all. I wanted to just include them. We rely pretty heavily on the National Governors Association recommendations in our issue brief, and the Trust for America's Health recently came out with a good document analyzing the state-by-state policies. So if you want to know where your state stands, this would be a really good, I would encourage all of you to check those out. And this is me. We have our issue brief available on our website. And I'll be happy to take any questions once we're done. Okay. I think we're going to hold questions to the end. Is it okay?